It's Thursday, February 11th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Coming up, opposites are attracting attention on the road to the White House. Global investors hit by another big speed bump as the head of the U.S. Central Bank speaks.
Prices have grown during the crisis, but I have decided to go in and have a look. Chinese cars, by their price, are good.
Turbulent markets make for a rough ride in the Russian car sales. Also ahead, Mariah Carey is back to hit more high notes. It's all coming up on today's International Edition. Vermont Socialist Senator Bernie Sanders and New York billionaire businessman Donald Trump emerged as the respective winners in the New Hampshire state presidential primary election Tuesday. Sanders handily defeated former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton 60-38% and said his victory sent a message to the nation.
Together, we have sent the message that the government of our great country belongs to all of the people and not just a handful of wealthy campaign contributors and their super PACs.
Trump bested the other eight Republican hopefuls, taking 35% of the vote, with Ohio Governor John Kasich coming in a distant second at 16%. Trump, speaking to his supporters, took aim at Sanders for wanting to give away the country and said he won't let that happen.
We're going to beat all of these countries that are taking so much of our money away from us on a daily basis. It's not going to happen anymore. We are going to do something so good and so fast and so strong, and the world is going to respect us again. Believe me.
Most presidential candidates over the past 60 years who have won New Hampshire went on to win the White House in the November election. Of course, there are some notable exceptions, most recently President Obama. Jeffrey Skelling at the University of Virginia Center for Politics tells VOA's Victor Beatty the Sanders win is an astounding against what is still to be presumed to be the eventual Democratic nominee.
Not only did he win, he won basically by the upper limit of what people could have expected, perhaps even exceeded it. Hillary Clinton is actually below where she finished in 2008, and that's pretty remarkable, given that it was more or less a three-way race in 2008, where she won just shy of 40% of the vote to win the New Hampshire primary. There's a regional factor in that, and Sanders is from right next door, but still, nonetheless, 6-7 months ago, if you told us that Bernie Sanders would be in a position to win 60% of the vote in New Hampshire, I think most of us would have probably chuckled at the idea.
Does this say more about Hillary Clinton than it does Bernie Sanders?
It was probably always somewhat hopeless for her to imagine that she would have a completely unfettered, easy ride to the nomination, just simply because she has not had a strong history on the campaign trail. She is very close to Wall Street, or at least has been historically, and that is a major issue for a lot of liberals right now. You know, you have to give him some credit here, too, in the sense that it's not just that Hillary Clinton hasn't been as strong as she might have hoped. Sanders has proven to be much stronger than a lot of people would have expected.
Jeffrey, there are a number of reports out there that former New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg may enter the race as an independent. If he does, or somebody else looks at these results and decides on the Democratic side to jump in, how will that change the race?
Well, if Michael Bloomberg runs as an independent, that will be very bad news for Democrats, because while it's very difficult to believe that Bloomberg would be able to do well or even be close to winning, there's a long track record in this country of third-party independent candidates failing, having perhaps some bright moments when they were leading the polls, but in the end, a lot of voters end up coming home to their respective parties.
On the Republican side, what does this mean for Donald Trump and for Governor John Kasich?
For Donald Trump, the answer is pretty easy. He's won this, and now he's actually got a win under his belt. For Kasich, he's going to take this second-place win and use it as a ticket to keep on riding the campaign trail. I'm not going to say this is a means to him winning the nomination or anything, but he's going to be able to stay in the fight and probably raise some more money because of it, and voters are going to give him a second look. I mean, that's really what New Hampshire is doing for a lot of these candidates. For Kasich, I think, and Sanders particularly, that they're going to get second looks.
Well, for the first time in New Hampshire, at least five candidates finished in double digits, and that suggests a very fractured electorate. Two of the Republican contenders who didn't fare so well in New Hampshire won't be making the journey to the next stop, that's South Carolina. Michael Lippin joins us now in the studio for social media reaction to the latest presidential candidates to drop out of this 2016 race. Michael, who's out this time?
Hi, Jim. Thank you. Well, just in the last 2 hours, we've had reports that two prominent Republicans are suspending their campaigns. The only woman who is in the race, former high-tech CEO Carly Fiorina, and the governor of the state of New Jersey, Chris Christie. Christie got 7% of the New Hampshire vote, while Fiorina had 4%. Now, as of a short time ago, Christie hadn't announced his departure from the race publicly, but quite a few U.S. news outlets have quoted his campaign sources as saying that the New Jersey governor shared his decision to drop out in a private call with his staff earlier Wednesday. Now, a formal announcement about Christie's campaign is likely to come on his social media sites. He is on Twitter at Chris Christie, and his Facebook page name is GovChristie. So I would definitely keep an eye on those sites in the coming hours.
Absolutely. Let's turn to Fiorina. How did she make her announcement?
Well, Carly Fiorina posted a statement onto her Facebook page with quite a defiant tone. She vowed to continue traveling the country to fight for those Americans who she says refuse to settle for the status quo that no longer works for them. Fiorina also had a message for young American girls and women, saying they should not listen to people who tell them they must vote for a certain candidate because they're a woman. Now, one of the most popular responses to Fiorina's Facebook statement comes from Facebook user Rachel Walker, and she wrote this. Thank you for being a wonderful role model to my daughter and young women everywhere. I would love to vote for you to be our first female vice president this year. So maybe she still has a shot at high office. We'll have to see.
Perhaps. Well, remaining in the race for social media is our own Michael Lippin. You can follow him on Twitter at Michael_Lippin and on our program account at VOA_IE. This is VOA.
News is mobile and so are you. Get VOA on the go. Get VOA on Google Currents. Get VOA News specifically made for your tablet and smartphone. Clean, simple, fast. Now available for Android or Apple phones or tablets. Download the Google Currents app for free today. Get VOA on Google Currents at voanews.com/currents.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
This is VOA's International Edition. Japanese stocks sustained another day of huge losses Wednesday, one day after they fell a staggering 5.4%. The Nikkei dropped another 2.3% to end the day at its lowest mark since October 2014. Australia's benchmark also down over 1%. U.S. markets ended flat. Indexes in Shanghai, Hong Kong, Taipei, and Seoul remained closed for the Lunar New Year. Investors are questioning whether some of Europe's biggest banks have sufficient capital reserves on hand to buffer against a slump in their share prices. The head of the U.S. Central Bank, Federal Reserve Chair Janet Yellen, testified before key congressional committees Wednesday. And for more on that, we're joined by Jill Malandrino at our New York Bureau.
It certainly did lend to more uncertainty in the market, but overall, she's going to stick the course. Essentially, she was saying global risks have certainly intensified and could slow the economy, but she doesn't expect a situation where it's necessary to cut rates. There has been a lot of conversation in the media that potentially a negative rate situation could occur, like Japan, but I don't think that's something that's going to happen. It's certainly within her wheelhouse, but I don't think we'll get to that. She also stated there's always a risk of recession, and global financial developments could produce a slowing in the economy, but the fact that she wants to stay the course, she believes the U.S. will stay on a path of moderate growth, that will allow the Fed to pursue gradual adjustments to monetary policy, and considering we've really been under a Federal Reserve put for the past 6 years, I think it's a big shock to the trading creating an investor system, because it's tough to reverse psychology over a 6-year trend like that.
Yellen also had some worries about the growth and glut of crude oil and other commodities on the global markets, contributing, of course, to the recent fall in oil prices. What is happening with oil?
I think we're still going to continue to see volatility and a little bit more destruction in the price, not to be a negative Nelly, but at the end of the day, there is no clear leadership. Is OPEC taking control? Are the U.S. and non-OPEC nations responsible for the glut in the system? Yesterday, two government agencies reported that the oversupply has actually gotten worse, not gotten better. Until we start to see producers take supply out of the system or cut back on production, we're going to remain in the supply glut. What's interesting, yesterday, Reuters reported, according to sources, the company has not confirmed this, that Valero, the U.S.'s top independent refiner, is planned to cut 25% production in Tennessee. Now, if that actually is the case, that's a tremendous move, because it would be the first time that we've seen capitulation in the market and a major global publicly traded company is dialing back on production.
With all this uncertainty in the market, one thing is for sure, we get great observations and information from Jill Malandrino in our New York bureau. Jill, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
Janet Yellen's comments were also closely watched outside of the United States, as we're now joined by International Business Times reporter Owen Davis to analyze what the markets were listening for.
The market pays close attention to everything that Janet Yellen says to try to understand what the Federal Reserve has in store. And a lot of what she says is already known to everyone who closely watches what's happening in the economy. They know what the employment situation is already. They're well aware of the volatility. But they want to see how much she's paying attention, how much the Fed is paying attention to what the markets are doing.
How about for foreign markets? How closely do they watch what the U.S. Federal Reserve is doing? How does it affect them?
Well, it affects foreign markets because when the Federal Reserve raises interest rates, it makes the dollar more attractive and it brings capital into the United States. When the dollar strengthens, that hurts foreign currencies. At the same time, that also hurts U.S. exporters because it makes the cost of U.S. goods more expensive, and people in other countries are less likely to buy more expensive goods. There's also the impact of central banks around the world being at odds right now. You have the Bank of Japan has lowered interest rates. The ECB, European Central Bank, has lowered interest rates. So you have these central banks moving in opposite directions as the Federal Reserve tries to raise them. So some of those tensions between currencies are being exacerbated right now.
Japan actually went to a negative rate. What does that mean?
Right. So a negative rate is their attempt to juice spending even more. Right now, for retail savers, they're not going to be charged to hold money in the bank. But for banks holding money with the central bank, they're actually being charged to hold that money there rather than receiving interest on those deposits like you would normally for a deposit. So the intent there is to try to get banks lending and try to get people spending. It's a classic monetary policy tool just taken to an extreme that we haven't seen in recent history. The Federal Reserve has looked at that question of whether to bring U.S. interest rates into negative territory, and that was a source of a lot of questioning and scrutiny on Capitol Hill today when Yellen was speaking with the House of Representatives. It looks like right now the Federal Reserve is not planning to go negative in the case of a downturn or a slowdown in the U.S. economy, but it remains a possibility. And what we did learn today is that they've been looking at it.
And that's a pretty extreme measure. I don't think we've heard the Fed actually talking about a negative rate, have we?
There have been whispers here or there, and only recently has it become a more out-and-out conversation. One of the Federal Reserve governors who just stepped off the rate-setting committee has just recently published a blog post arguing, yes, we should go negative. That's what we need right now. The economy is not where it should be. It's a conversation that has certainly picked up some steam as Bank of Japan and others have gone negative in recent months.
We've gotten a lot of great positive information from Owen Davis, financial writer for International Business Times. Owen, thanks for spending a little time with us.
Thanks. I appreciate it.
Car sales in Russia dropped more than a third in 2015 because of that country's economic woes. But at the extreme ends of the car market, luxury vehicles and some economy brands are actually experiencing growth. We hear more now from VOA's Daniel Sharif, who reports from Moscow.
Car sales in Russia last year fell by a whopping 36% as the economy shrank and inflation soared. But the devalued ruble, ironically, drove sales of luxury cars as wealthy Russians invested cash in physical assets. Some economy brands are also steering away from Russia's downward trend and attracting customers.
The prices have grown during the crisis, but I have decided to go in and have a look. Chinese cars, by their price, are good.
A Moscow dealer for the Chinese brand Brilliance says he expects sales to keep growing as the company's policy builds on market conditions.
That's why it has a good future, as today many European brands are beyond the purchasing ability of the Russian customer, which is low due to the exchange rate of more than 70 rubles per dollar. Many people change from European or American cars to Chinese cars.
As wages have fallen, many Russians have cut costs by taking public transport and scaling back plans to buy cars.
Purchasing a new car is not one of my financial priorities because mine is not so old. And because of the crisis, I'm pushing this off for now. I'd like to buy a nice big car, but at the moment I can't. I need to start small.
Meanwhile, Moscow's notorious traffic jams seemingly have not been alleviated by the drop in car sales. Daniel Scherf, VOA News, Moscow.
You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
I'm Millar Sega, host of VOA's The Correspondents, a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support, Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that inflicts almost every country.
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day, wherever the news may be. Our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondents, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
We, of course, have the latest musical news, this time on Mariah Carey and with International Edition host Susan Yockey.
Border Crossing's Larry London has joined me here in the studio with news from the music world. And today we're going to talk about super-duper star Mariah Carey, who Larry tells me everybody knows. Everybody knows that, Mariah.
There isn't a person on the planet other than you, Susan, who doesn't know Mariah Carey. 200 million albums sold. She is... without question, the ultimate diva in music. She's won 5 Grammys, 19 music awards. She was the artist of the millennium. She had a number one hit in every year of the 90s, only artist to do that. So, she's right up there with the creme de la creme.
So what's she up to now?
Well, I'm glad you asked. Uh-huh. There's some big news about Mariah Carey. It's not music news.
Oh.
I don't have music news today because Mariah hasn't had an album out for a little bit. You know, she put out an album in 2014, and that was her last new album, although I understand there's a plan for her to work on a new album sometime this year. But she's not in a rush because she's got a Las Vegas residency. She's performing regularly in a hotel casino in Las Vegas.
That's like, a good gig.
That's what everybody seems to be doing now. Jennifer Lopez, Celine Dion's been doing it for years, and so now Mariah's got her regular thing going on. But here's the news that's very exciting for Mariah Carey. She just got engaged.
Oh, congratulations.
Yes, that's right, Susan. It's her third marriage. She was once married to Tommy Mottola, who ran Sony Music at the time. And that marriage lasted a few years. Then she married Nick Cannon. They have 2 children together, Monroe and Moroccan, and got divorced last year. And now Mariah has moved down and found new love with a billionaire whose name is James Packer.
And the ring?
Oh, of course, and the ring, the 35-carat diamond ring.
Woo! She can use that in her show to light the stage.
She does, as a matter of fact. It was a newspaper story in Las Vegas that the diamond ring stole the show and was distracting everybody.
Ooh, well, let's listen to one of her songs, Always Be My Baby.
Down.
in time, and it seemed everlasting that you would always be mine.
Well, thank you, Larry. It's always nice to have you stop by the studio.
Thank you, Susan. It's always a pleasure to be here in the studio.
I ain't gonna cry, no, and I won't beg you to stay. If you're determined to leave, boy, I will not stay.
You've been listening to International Edition. You can find us at our website anytime you like at voanews.com. We're also on Twitter. Follow us at @VOA_IE. And thanks to all of our Facebook Asia friends who joined us briefly in this program. Our director is Tracy Carter, engineer Dan Crafton. I'm Jim Stevenson. Thanks for joining us and have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
There is a rising tide of religious persecution emerging worldwide, and it disproportionately threatens religious minority groups. This threat touches Christians in the Middle East, Yazidis in Iraq, Baha'is in Iran, Hindus in Pakistan and Bangladesh, Muslims in India, or Sunni Muslims in Shia areas, or vice versa. The threat, said Special Advisor for Religious Minorities in the Near East and South and Central Asia, Knox Thames, is clear and present. Terrorists and non-state actors such as ISIL, the Nusra Front, and Al-Qaeda are some of the worst persecutors of religious minorities. But individual attackers have also perpetrated acts of violence against religious minorities. And unfortunately, in far too many places, governments continue to limit the exercise of religious freedoms. Protecting and promoting the universal right to freedom of religion is central to American foreign policy. Not only is it the right thing to do, said Special Advisor Knox, it is a smart thing to do as it plays a major role in contributing to more stable, progressive, and dynamic societies. Wherever people face religious persecution, the United States is at work finding ways to help. For example, the U.S. pressures governments to enact reforms so that religious minorities are able to freely practice their faith. Militarily, through airstrikes, the U.S. is providing protection for minority religions to remain in their ancestral homeland. The U.S. continues to provide humanitarian assistance to Syrians and Iraqis, including refugees and displaced populations, and supports resettlement for those who cannot safely return home. The U.S. is encouraging countries in the Middle East to support, through education, respect for human rights and religious freedom. Governments in the region are also being urged to take steps to protect religious minorities during holy days and religious gatherings. The United States, said President Barack Obama, will continue to work with a broad coalition against those who have subjected religious minorities to unspeakable violence and persecution. All people deserve the fundamental dignity of practicing their faith free from fear, intimidation, and violence.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.